CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives for tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers. Lee, please introduce our sponsors.
Absolutely. Today's show is brought to you by Delaney Consulting, LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney's as outstanding and excellent. Also, SAP Business by Design, a fully integrated business management software solution designed for small to mid-sized companies that want the benefits of large-scale business applications without the need for a large IT infrastructure. And Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and other financial executives. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter.
And in this week's CFO Radio News, earlier this year, the Committee of Sponsoring Organizations, known as COSO, of the Treadway Commission, reported the dollar value of fraudulent financial reporting soared in the last decade, despite the implementation of Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002. Companies involved in fraud were much larger than those observed in their earlier 1988 to 97 study. And here are the findings. Fraud occurred most frequently in the computer hardware and software industries. The SEC cited a company's chief executive officer and or chief financial officer for some level of involvement in 89% of fraud cases studied. The most common fraud techniques involved improper revenue recognition, followed by overstatement of assets and bogus expense recognition. Among firms involved in fraud, 26% changed their auditors between the filing of the final clean financial statement and their final fraudulent financial statement. The most common cited motives for fraud included the desire to meet earning expectations, conceal the company's deteriorating financial condition, bolster performance for pending equity or debt financing, or to increase management compensation. There appears to be no difference between the number of character of frauds since the passage of Sarbanes-Oxley. Fraudulent firms disclosed significantly more related party transactions than non-fraudulent firms, and all 347 firms prosecuted by the SEC for financial fraud during the decade studied received unqualified opinions from their auditors for the final set of misstated financial filings. Financial statement fraud sometimes implicated the external auditor, and the consequences associated with financial statement fraud were severe for the individuals allegedly involved. However, the severity of the penalties may not be a sufficient deterrent, the COSO believes. So why are we here talking today about fraud and specifically securities fraud? Well, today David Sawyer joins us to discuss the role of the CFO and the impact in terms of fraud and inappropriate behavior. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, David, you are managing partner of Sawyer & Company, LLC. You're a forensic accountant and litigation advisor, and you've served as consulting or testifying expert in dozens of investigations involving fraud, corruption, embezzlement, and a whole variety of other legal disputes. And also, formerly, you were an internal auditor for Fortune 500 corporations. And today, you regularly consult with businesses on improvements on internal controls and fraud prevention and detection. I understand your clients have included not only the law enforcement and prosecutors, senior executives and managers, board of directors, audit committees, general counsel, attorneys, and litigators for governments, and publicly traded global corporations and privately owned businesses. My goodness, what a list.
Sure. It's a winding path, that's for sure.
Well, David, let's begin at the beginning of your career. You've got a degree in accounting, and you're a certified public accountant, a certified fraud examiner, and a certified internal auditor. You've got the certifieds covered there, huh?
A lot of alphabet soup, a lot of certifications and credentials. It's all about the educational process.
Well, sure. You've begun as an auditor, so tell us how you got started. What was your first position out of college?
You know, it's kind of interesting how my interest in accounting got started in college. My initial interest began in accounting because I was interested in a career in federal law enforcement. When I graduated from college, all the federal agencies were in a hiring freeze, and I had all these applications in, so I figured, well, the advice that I got from some people that I trusted very much was, well, go ahead and get a job in public accounting, get your CPA out of the way, and then, you know, when the government comes out of the hiring freeze, you'll be a more attractive candidate. And so that happened. I grew up in Mobile, Alabama, on the Gulf Coast, and worked with a couple of local CPA firms there on the Gulf Coast, got my CPA, and realized that to really focus on this long-term interest that I had in forensic and investigative accounting, I was going to have to work for probably an internal audit department at a global corporation or one of the big four accounting firms. And that's kind of where I began this career search to begin narrowing that focus into control breakdowns and control weaknesses and how they break down.
And, of course, these were the days where I think you and me, when we started, there was actually a fairly meaty management report. The auditors were actually on the kindness perspective of pointing out internal control weaknesses, and there wasn't quite the same focus that there is today. So there was a lot of counseling and consulting.
It's interesting. The way that I point to it is when I was in college, when we were both in college, we get out in the early 90s, there was no mention of the F word in fraud or forensic. In the auditing textbooks, it was referred to as errors and irregularities, as if irregularities, as you could correct the problem with a high-fiber diet. That's about the mention that they gave of fraud and forensics in college when we were in school. It just hadn't gotten that much notoriety when we were around. But to kind of bring that career path, I had just accepted a job with a Fortune 500 internal audit department. And I had been married for about 2 months. And it was at this point that the government came out of the hiring freeze. And this becomes a little humorous at this point, or it takes an interesting twist. But I had been interviewing or had been processed with agencies like FBI, Secret Service, IRS, CID. It was not one of these typically white-collar related law enforcement agencies that made the offer. It was the Drug Enforcement Administration. And I'm thinking to myself, what in the world does the DEA want with me? I'm a geek bean counter, for heaven's sakes. I've been married for 2 months. And they said, well, we like CPAs because they help us investigate the money laundering through the drug cartels. And I was going to be, you know, wearing a bulletproof vest and carrying a piece and had a slot at their training facility in Quantico, and I got to thinking I was going to have to take about a 50% pay cut. My wife would have probably killed me before the drug dealers would have, because she would have never known where I was. So it was at that point that I kind of made a career decision to stay the private and corporate consulting route, which has worked out well. It's interesting how things come full circle. Recently, I was working a case where I was engaged by the United States Attorney's Office as an expert, and guess what we were investigating, testifying to? Drug conspiracy and money laundering, where they had swept up about a couple of dozen Mexican cocaine dealers here in the southeast, and they invited me in to investigate the money laundering on that case, which was a very
fun stuff.
Yeah, we see some in forensic accounting. We see a lot of things that that are just kind of beyond the pale of traditional accounting that you just wouldn't see on an everyday basis. So it makes it intriguing for me, and it keeps you mentally sharp and keeps things interesting.
So do you have any advice that perhaps for somebody listening to the radio show today, they're beginning their career and they've got a desire to become a fraud examiner, should they start as an auditor today?
I get that question all the time. I believe that you can come from any different background. I think for me, it helped to start out in accounting as an auditor. And while I saw a lot of my peers going to work for a lot of the larger global and national firms straight out of college, it was great for me to work with a local firm because I got to see every aspect of a business, from sales tax returns, payroll tax returns, all the way through compilation review and audit. And I did the tax returns, the corporate partnership and individual tax returns for those companies. So I got a full scope look at the entire business. In addition, that's helped me to be able to more efficiently and effectively run my own business. So, and later I got experience with the forensic units of a couple of the big four accounting firms. So it worked out very well. But the point is that building a career is a lot like building a pyramid. You start out with a very broad base. You're more or less a generalist. But as you build on top of each layer, your focus becomes more and more narrow.
I like how you present that, because I think that's a very good way for, particularly in today's economy, and looking at human capital, there tends to be a thought that there's not been a lot of loyalty shown from the big corporations in the last 10 years, and the millennium children of today probably aren't going to show any loyalty back, and they'll probably have dozens of jobs in their lifetime.
That's very true, as has been true for me, and that's what the statistics and the studies show these days, that people just don't stick with a job for 20 or 30 years like our parents probably did. The key to developing that career is, if you have a long-term strategic goal, the shorter-term tactical decisions become a lot easier. So that's kind of the thing, and sometimes it's rare for people to have that long-term vision and strategy of what they want to do. But if you can work that out, and it takes refining over time, but if you can work that out earlier, it sure helps in your long-term career goals.
Sure. Well, let's compare some of those early internal audit Fortune 500 companies and kind of the sexy being on trial and drug enforcements and those kinds of things. What was one of the most interesting experiences in your large corporation time frame?
There have been such a number of them, and a lot of that exposure to large global companies came from my time with the Big Four forensic accounting units. We worked a case when I was with one firm that involved an American bank buying a large Brazilian bank, where the previous owners of that Brazilian bank, after it was sold to the acquiring American company, I won't mention any names, I'll keep this sanitized as much as I can, they effectively looted the bank that they had just sold and embezzled, north of $35 million.
Way to go.
Yeah.
I always guide people, watch out for the partners you get in bed with.
Yeah, exactly. And this was through a series of illegal, what they called overdrafts, but it was discovered by the internal auditors at the bank. And we were brought in to consult and do a further investigation and testify as expert witnesses on that case. Also, on the litigation support side, we do a lot of litigation support now. Worked on a very large case involving the development of a stealth aircraft. At that point in time, it was the largest contract dispute in United States history. I'm a big airplane, military aircraft buff, and I believe the damages on this thing was between $4 and $5 billion, and it was a project that was canceled by the U.S. government. But the technology that was involved in being able to look and sit in the actual mock-up of the airplane that never left the ground, they never could make it fly, but it was just very interesting. You get to see some very, very interesting things, and I credit my experience with a couple of Big Four accounting firms for that.
Wow. So. Well, interestingly enough, we're getting on to some very specific topics. Fraud investigations are often thought of the sexy side of accounting and finance. However, maybe based on your impressive background and the research that I've done, I would imagine that your work has enabled to put a couple of people in jail. Is it sexy, or is it just plain hard work?
Great description. We hear that description, sexy, all the time, and I think this whole word forensic has just developed a lot of intrigue since this whole CSI phenomenon came about 10 years ago. I can tell you right now that we certainly don't solve every case that we work on. Well, let me say this. We never solve any cases in the period of time that it takes for an hour-long TV episode. Cases can drag on for years, in fact. We just wrapped up a case that had been dormant for 2 or 3 years, and we finally wrapped it up successfully, I might add. But really, to clarify what forensic is, all it means is that it's related to the court system. It can be on the criminal prosecution side, where the objective is to lock someone up in jail, or it can be on the civil litigation side, where the objective is to recover monetary damages. We see things that are very interesting. My work, I'm a CPA by background, but of course, we've been asked, or the AICPA defines other forensic services to include computer forensics, and we've been asked to do a lot of that too. Very interestingly, last year we were brought in to testify on the defense side of a capital murder case. And it had been tried, oddly, 3 times. The first conviction was overturned because evidence had been suppressed by the prosecution. The second trial ended in a hung jury. We were brought in to testify on the third case. What we were asked to testify is that evidence had not been preserved on the computers. I'm also a licensed private investigator, but we were also asked to testify that, or what we saw in the way the case was handled, that law enforcement didn't follow proper forensic and investigative procedure. And we testified for the defense, and the defendant was acquitted in this case. And so we get to see things that are they're very interesting that you just wouldn't expect for a forensic accountant to see.
And in addition to that, I think I found my new best friend. In case I ever get into any trouble, I think you're the guy I'm going to call, right?
Well, I know a lot of people, and including attorneys and a lot of forensic experts that can really be helpful in these types of engagements.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about Sarbanes-Oxley. Our news introduction talked about how things really haven't changed. In fact, they've got a whole lot worse in a post-Sarbanes-Oxley world. Do you think that there is anything that has become routine at this point in terms of Sarbanes-Oxley? Do you think that potentially there's just now a light being shone on the area in a deeper level? Why do you think that we're not seeing an improvement?
Sarbanes-Oxley, there are several different factors that I see that are at work. Sarbanes-Oxley, I believe the spirit of it was done with absolutely the best intentions. However, legislators are not necessarily accountants. The implementation of Sarbanes-Oxley has created a pretty drastic efficiency drain, not to mention a monetary drain on the companies that are the public companies that are required to abide by it and to implement it. Under Sarbanes-Oxley, the C-suite is basically responsible for not just presenting that the financial statements are presented in accordance with U.S. General Accepted Accounting Principles, GAAP, but that they fairly present the financial condition of the company. There can't be off-book transactions like we saw in Enron and monkey business that went on with WorldCom, things like that. There may be some revision, some tweaking to Sarbanes-Oxley. I've been hearing rumblings about that in legislative circles. But the fact that it has been followed by an economic recession creates difficulties too, and increases, in fact, the motivation for people to cook their books, to manage or inflate their earnings. So it's very difficult times for it to really determine how effective it's been over time. There are many schools of thought on how effective it has been.
One could argue that it's lined the pocket of an awful lot of CPA firms and an awful lot of lawyers.
Yeah, no doubt. No question about it. The big four consulting firms and second tier firms as well have been engaged in massive consulting engagements for years on end. Especially with the large global corporations. There's been a lot of fallout, and I think it's been received with mixed reviews. And initially, the spirit of it, I think the intentions were good, but no one had any idea of the fallout, of how difficult and complicated it would be to implement it.
Well, let's take that back down to maybe the SBA the Small Business Administration considers a small company to be one with fewer than 500 employees. And the last statistics that were published detailed that 99.7% of employer firms in the United States were actually SBAs. They were smaller than 500 employees. So let's look at the small business. My business, as I work with small, fast-growing entrepreneurs, and we look back at the tragedies of all these scandals and frauds that we're talking about, one of the challenges for a small business owner is that he or she worries about the first time of giving somebody access to their bank. Do you see any consistent element in the cases that you've found that could be a lesson learned to these entrepreneurs as they grow their business?
Yeah. Statistics also show, and I'll also cite the ACFE's report, and this is probably a pretty good segue for us to talk about that. Every 2 years, the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners issues what they call the Report to the Nations on Occupational Fraud and Abuse. They take actual case studies from CFEs worldwide, usually it's between 1,700 to 1,900 cases. And they take the statistics, compile them into a statistical model, and publish this report, and they extrapolate that data to the gross world product. It used to be the gross domestic product. But they say that globally, fraud cost, on average, or on the median, I would say, that fraud costs the typical business 5% of its revenue. And based in terms of global gross world product, that's about $5 trillion annually that it costs the world's economy.
That's larger than most countries' economies in the world.
That's exactly
apart
right.
From the large few.
That's exactly right. And speaking of ACFE, I'm the president of the Georgia chapter of ACFE. And if I can put this plug in, we are having our annual learning event. We have monthly meetings the first Friday of every month, but this coming Friday, October 15th, we'll be holding our annual learning event, 9 hours of continuing education. The keynote speaker will be the special agent in charge of the Atlanta FBI office, Brian Lampkin. We're excited about that. We'll give statistics from the most recent, the 2010 release of the Georgia, the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners report of the nations. We'll have speakers from academic people who will talk about data analytics, which is very important to a fraud examiner's toolbox. We will also have a segment on Homeland Security, which is actually a requirement for private investigators to maintain their continuing education. So at ACFE, that's something that we're really doing is reaching out to other organizations in the community, IIA, GrefPAC, Metropol, law enforcement, building a partnership with those folks. So
this would be a good opportunity for those that potentially considering what is CFE, what is a fraud examiner. Maybe they could come, spend the day, learn about it. They'll get some great education. And just for the listeners, please tune in to the next four radio shows because CFO Radio will actually be covering it for purposes of press and newscasts in the following month, probably for November and early December, will actually cover some excerpts from the event.
Outstanding. And the CPE, I mean, for per hour, it's like $20, less than $20 for an hour, which is a great deal.
That's outstanding.
Yeah, and it gives you a great broad stroke look at what ACFE is about, both here in Georgia and nationally.
Well, that's terrific. That really is terrific. So let's talk a little bit about these small companies, and we've talked a little bit about the money. Is it the case that those with access to the money are thought of the ones being the fraudsters? Is it always the financial employees who commit the fraud, or is it broader than that?
Most of the time, it's going to be someone who has access to the funds. And this is something that is important to me as a former internal auditor and as a fraud investigator. Typical small companies have trouble segregating the four A's: the access to the assets, the approval and the authorization, the audit and the analysis side of things, and the accounting side of things. Those four areas, those four A's, if you will, should be separated. And the studies show, and in my experience shows, that it's the smaller companies that have more difficulty with fraud because they have people that are longtime trusted employees, and this is where we get into
maybe family members.
Exactly. Yeah. This is the typical profile of the white collar criminal.
They may not have an audit.
Absolutely.
They may purely have a CPA to do tax returns, and that's not an audit.
Exactly. Not in anywhere close. And audits, financial statement audits, in and of themselves are not designed to detect fraud. They just don't look at that level of materiality. Most internal occupational fraud, 88% of the cases committed are asset theft, which are far below the materiality threshold. It seems that the larger corporations don't have as much of a problem with that because they're able to separate the duties. It's the smaller businesses that we really focus on that we really see the problems crop up because they're not able to separate the duties. They have the person who's writing the checks doing the bank reconciliations, and they're getting the canceled checks in the mail, and if they're embezzling funds, they're destroying the canceled checks, and they're doctoring the bank reconciliation, or they're setting up fictitious vendors. There can be any litany of different types of fraud schemes that they could be carrying out, and that's where we see it be most problematic, is that the small, closely held businesses.
And one of the things that I see today in that small business is that in the old days, we used to be able to follow a paper trail, and it was very easy to lock up, secure the checkbook, make sure that the owner's signature needed to be on or somebody at an appropriate level needed to be a signer. But in today's world, very often when I speak to the small business owner, they are not aware of the implication of giving Johnny or Susan access to the online bank account. Oh, and by the way, all of the bank accounts. They don't understand that.
Absolutely. A lot of online banking has made it much easier for the fraudster. The fact that they don't actually receive physical canceled checks anymore, they're just receiving images of the checks.
And something can happen so quickly. Johnny's already run. Susan's already run. She's in a different country at this point before they've even got to reconciling the bank statement for the month.
That's exactly right. And most business owners, they're focused on the operational side. They're focused on doing what they do best. Their core skill competency is running a business, running a manufacturing business, a carpet installation company, flooring, roofing, what have you. You pick. I've seen it happen to CPAs. I'm working a case right now where a CPA, his bookkeeper office manager embezzled some $90,000. The typical fraud goes on for 18 months before it's even detected. The fraudster tests the water, and they see what they can get away with, and eventually it becomes so large that it's
now going to be seen.
Yeah.
They've got comfortable, and now they're ripping off real money.
Exactly. And most companies, because of fear to the damage to their reputation, the public embarrassment.
They don't prosecute.
They won't prosecute. And it sends the wrong message to their employees that this tone at the top is that we don't have a zero-tolerance policy, that we're just going to sweep this under the rug. And what message does that send to your employees?
Yeah.
Hey, great ideas for later down the road if I need to supplement my income, which is what we're seeing in this economy with unemployment the way that it is. Typical motivators for fraud are either need or greed. In past years, it's been more greed-related to supplement a certain lifestyle level. Now, when, say, a spouse has been laid off or pay cuts have been implemented, it's more need. It's mm-hmm. more to put groceries on their table.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that the business entrepreneur, which, quite frankly, may be a $50 million business, $100 million business, should he or she go take some accounting classes? Not necessarily CPE-type credits, but certainly my company offers those kind of classes. Is that a good move for an entrepreneur and business owner?
Absolutely. What we always say is that an ounce of prevention can be worth a pound or more of the cure. To take a proactive stance before the horses have left the barn and the toothpaste is out of the tube, take some proactive steps. Do a fraud risk assessment of your organization. Look at your processes, where your control weaknesses may be. And we've been asked, and we've had an increasing demand to do that on a national level. We're talking with multiple firms on a national level about doing proactive fraud risk assessment, control risk assessment type steps. In essence, we've taken more than 100 cases, investigations that I've done in the past 10 to 15 years, reverse engineering that because we know what can go wrong, but putting that into a more proactive stance to where we can prevent fraud before it happens.
So let's go back to the beginning for the company. One big mistake that I see a lot of small business entrepreneurs is that they hire people for the finance accounting department. They don't even do a background check. They don't do a credentials check. It costs, maybe between $120 and $200 for that hiring. It is such a low cost compared to the risk.
It's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
Always do a complete background check.
Criminal, local, federal.
Yeah, do a multi-state criminal background check. We had a case of a counterfeiting case a few years back where they had done a one-state criminal background check, and this woman who, in a single check, had embezzled it was essentially a counterfeiting ring that she was working with as an outside accomplice. In one single check, She embezzled $375,000.
Way to go, lady. Not good for the company.
Dreaming big, yeah. But the whole point was this woman had a criminal record, a felony conviction in another state.
And they just didn't check it.
This company only did a one-state criminal background check. She probably lied on her application. We see a lot of non-financial statement fraud, lying about credentials, lying on their resume.
So how can a company combat that? I mean, if I say, my name's Lorraine Chilvers, and this is where I live, and this is my social, and this is my driver's license number, what can a company and an employer do?
It's very difficult to get all the information. If you can imagine, in any investigation or in any hiring process for that matter, you can imagine a 500-piece puzzle, and we may only have 437 of the pieces. If you can put those 437 pieces together right, you're going to have a good idea what the picture on the cover of the box looks like at the end of the day. So you want to build a profile of this person. You want to get as much information as you can. Credit checks, get access to their information. Talk to their employers. And really spend some time with them. Know your employee, KYE. I mean, go through the actual steps that have been set up. Check their criminal background. That's another good thing as well.
And often that review of credit can lead you to loans in different states, which might be an indicator to say, hey, maybe you need to go check, did they ever live in that state?
Sure. And as much as what is there on their resume, look for things that are missing. If there are gaps in their employment, why are they leaving that out? Ask those questions, and it's as much looking for what is not there than what is there.
Yeah. Well, let's take the looking forward thought one step further, if we can. And something that was curious to me that I learned from looking at your background is that you've served on a technical advisory board for a company called Oversight Technologies, and I'm make sure that I've confirmed that I've got that right, and you'd supported actually one of our sponsors, SAP, where you were, and I'm quoting here, instrumental in the design of fraud detection queries for the company's application for SAP, among some other systems. Talk a little bit about the information technology in the last couple of minutes of the show.
Absolutely. Oversight Systems is a company based here in Atlanta, and I was asked to help them design an online real-time fraud detection or anomaly detection software package to identify the red flags for fraud and white-collar crime. Through my years of experience as an internal auditor and as a forensic accountant with Big Four firms, through time, I kind of accumulated this battery of hundreds of different tests that you can run on data. Data analytics is what we call them, or forensic data queries is what we call them, that identify red flags of things that should be further investigated. And that is what Oversight does, and they market this to companies that work on an SAP platform, among others. And we mentioned that there's others. I think PeopleSoft and Oracle are other systems that they work on. But and they've taken that platform that I provided and built it into a pretty wonderful, well-developed product in essence, and I don't want to overstate the capabilities of their product, but they can, in essence, identify a suspicious transaction and stop it before the money has left the firm. It's that fast.
And so this would be a software that a company could implement in addition to their existing maybe ERP package that would work in conjunction looking at some of the transactions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I've heard great reviews from their clients.
And I'm sure there are other companies out there that do similar sorts of things.
There are. Most of them do it on a one-off basis. I think Oversight is designed to do it throughout time. It can be modified to suit certain situations. But it just speaks to the power that the processing power of computers, data capacity that we have. Just a few years ago, Microsoft Excel only had a capacity of 65,000 lines. Now it's over a million. What I see is a kind of a convergence of Microsoft Excel and Microsoft Access, because they're starting to look so much like each other. I predict.
People don't really use Access that much. They use the Excel that's currently there. It's the old Excel on drugs.
Yeah, it's on steroids, and it makes it very easy. It's user-friendly. It's a lot more user-friendly than Access, but they're working on Access. We do a lot of our data analytics in Access, in fact. Yeah.
Well, I hate to break off the conversations, David. We certainly have enjoyed your time, but we've come to the end of the show. But there's one final question. We have a tradition on the show to ask, what is your CFO tip of the month? Maybe yours will be with a flavor of fraud prevention. What's yours?
Wow. There's so many. And giving this some thought, I guess I'm always asked, what the tip would be. I'm a big fan of Ronald Reagan, and one thing that I always say is trust but verify to my clients. In any investigation that we do, I go through a process of what's called legitimization. When you know how a business process should work properly and set that up as a standard of comparison, any deviation from that, there's something wrong, and there's something that needs to be looked into further. It may not necessarily be fraudulent. It may just be a mistake, an error, an inefficiency, but it needs to be looked at further and vetted. We're not in the business of trying to prove guilt. We're in the business of trying to find the truth and proving it and supporting it. So that would be my advice. That's kind of the mantra of the way that we do our business. It's just a foundation in integrity.
Well, that is a great tip. Thank you. And thank you very much to David Sawyer, our guest today, for sharing your innermost thoughts on the role of the CFO and as it relates to that fraud and fraud prevention. Thank you also to our contributors, to Financial Executives International, and to our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses alike. Please go to DelaneyLLC.com. Thanks also to SAP Business by Design, the software as a service business management solution for small to medium-sized companies. For more information on that, go to www.sap.com. This and other thought leadership from today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. If you are a CFO and you'd like to be a guest on the show, please contact us via the web. And thank you to our listeners for listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chalvers signing off until next time.